Sarcoma Stories is a podcast created by Sarcoma Foundation of America to highlight the voices and experiences of patients, survivors, and care partners. After each episode, you can connect with others in the sarcoma community on our Sarcoma Stories podcast Facebook group to delve deeper into the episode's topics. You can find information on this specific subtype or your subtype, as well as all our podcast episodes on SFA's website, www.curesarcoma.org. Links are in this episode's description. Follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts to stay up to date on the latest episodes. Thanks for listening. SFA created Sarcoma Stories to highlight the individual stories of sarcoma patients, survivors, and care partners. To amplify the many stories we consistently hear and bring together the broad range of lived experiences of sarcoma patients, SFA has also created a Sarcoma Journey Survey. This survey is vitally important as we need to collect data for sarcoma subtypes to help advance research and effective treatments and put data to the stories we consistently hear. To learn more about this survey and to take the survey yourself, please head to the show notes and you'll find the survey link. On this episode, we speak with Sean Nerney, an actor, singer, and performer who is a Dorito enthusiast, an avid Knicks fan, and loving partner to Megan. Sean met his fiance Megan after she had been living with a diagnosis of fibromyxoid sarcoma on the dura of her brain for a few years. Sean takes us through their journey as a young couple navigating a sarcoma diagnosis, how his role as a care partner has evolved with their relationship and Megan's sarcoma experience, and how running has provided him with a way to help the sarcoma community while also being an outlet for his own self-care. Sean's humor and honesty are sure to resonate and shine a light on the feelings care partners may have when a loved one is facing sarcoma. Let's dive in. Welcome to Sarcoma Stories and welcome back if you have been listening already and joining in. I'm Tasha. I'm one of your hosts.
And I'm Brandy. I'm your other host.
And today we are speaking with Sean Nerney. Sean, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi there. My name is Sean Nerney. I'm very honored to be on the show.
Amazing. And Sean, what is your relationship to sarcoma?
So my fiance actually is dealing with a rare fibromyxoid sarcoma on the dura of her brain. She's been dealing with this since 2016. I came into the fold later. But yeah, when we started dating, I kind of was introduced to this world I had no idea even existed.
Yeah. And we got to say right off the bat, congratulations on your engagement. This is a recent development. Yeah. So exciting. At the time of recording this episode, Sean and Megan are newly engaged. They have a new puppy taking on life together. It is such a relevant experience at this point in time when we're recording the podcast, because it is just a week after, I think, Adolescent Young Adult Cancer Awareness Week. And you and Megan do fall into that age bracket where you are having these major life events while going through a sarcoma diagnosis.
Yeah. And I just want to say, I also think it's exciting that with the engagement, a new puppy, it's always exciting to see planning for the future. So even congratulations on being able to plan for the future.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I think that the coolest thing that it happened on accident really, but last March, Megan finished radiation and rang the bell towards healing. And then this March we got engaged. So it's amazing what a year can bring.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so great to hear. That's incredibly full circle. And I think a really hopeful statement for anybody who is finding themselves currently in the position of working towards ringing that bell. You have no idea what lies ahead in 1 year. And like Brandy said, hearing a story about future planning amidst a sarcoma diagnosis is incredible. Thank you for sharing that with us on the episode today. So I know you mentioned that you came into this world through Megan. She had actually already had her diagnosis the time that you met. So what was that like for you, being introduced to someone who is dealing with this and you're just almost catching up in a way?
Yeah, I think for me, it did come as a surprise, because I remember I actually found out about the sarcoma on our second date, we went mini golfing, and it was my idea to, this is also during the pandemic. So like you had to get really creative, and I am not a Casanova by any means. So I was like, let's go mini golfing. And so we decided to go mini golfing. And I had this idea that on every hole, we would ask each other a question. And on one of the holes, the question was, what's your biggest insecurity? And she said, okay, well, you go first. And I said, well, my biggest insecurity is actually, I bite my nails, which, you know, a lot of us do. And I still do. But I'll try not to do it on the episode. And Megan actually said her biggest insecurity was her hair. And I remember thinking that was a pretty unique response because she had beautiful hair. And she said, yeah, I actually had a brain surgery. And so this little part of my hair in the back of my head is a little bit shorter than the rest. And she pointed out, and I said, oh, I did notice that after she had pointed it out. And she said, yeah, I have a rare type of cancer. It's called a sarcoma. I had no idea what that was. And Megan said, yeah, and mine is very rare because a lot of the time sarcoma only finds itself in the brain if it's moved from another part of the body, but mine is primarily on the brain. And then she said something that I will have echoed many times, you know, in many doctors' women since, and to people that I'm trying to explain it to who don't know. And Megan and a lot of the doctors we visited, they say that they think Megan could be one of the first people that's ever had what she has. And so when you're fighting something that's rare, and obviously in the research, it only affects 1% of adults, but to be a 1% of a 1% is like a different ballpark to live in. And, you know, that was scary to hear at first. But then the more that I went to these doctor's appointments and got to understand, there's so much care that comes in this community. And that's the word I'm going to probably say a million times, a community. We are so thankful that we found you guys. You were a light in a super duper dark time. And then we didn't feel alone anymore. And I never wanted Megan to feel alone. I remember when she had her first scan, she said, oh yeah, I have to go get my MRI. And I said, oh, well, does anybody go with you? And she says, no, at this point, you know, I feel really comfortable going by myself. And I said, well, not anymore. And I've never missed a doctor's women since.
I have to call out first how clever that golf game is. I've never heard of a date like that. So I guess we now have dating tips on this episode here. Someone can borrow Sean's idea because that's incredible. What a great way to get to know someone. But I also am curious what it was like for you hearing that for the first time on a second date with this person who is now your fiance. What was that like for you?
Yeah, I don't want to say Megan downplayed it, but that's where I'll kind of land. I mean, she had been dealing with this since 2016, right? So it's 2020. She's 4 years past it. You know, she had since graduated college. She has an amazing full-time job, which she still does, work for Nabisco on the Oreo team. So everyone's favorite cookie at the grocery store when
Brandy
you're buying
loves
them.
Oreos. Yes. She's a huge Oreo
Brandy,
fan.
Brandy, you love Oreos?
My gosh, yes. Isn't I'm a cookie monster when it comes to Oreos.
Yes. Yes. Well, anyone listening, when you go to the grocery store, thank you so much for your purchase. So Megan had been dealing with this. And that's kind of just the way everyone deals with a cancer diagnosis so differently. And Megan was very private about it for as long as she could be. Unfortunately, she started dating someone with a big mouth. So when we needed prayers and support, you betcha we got it. I think for me, it was kind of like, she had said, oh yeah, like I'm good. And so I kind of was, okay, we're good. And in that timeline I sent you, there were gaps of it just being good. I didn't really fully grasp it until obviously everything started to really ramp up in 2023. But for me, it was just like, okay, we go to these MRIs. They tell us everything's the same. The same means good. And that was kind of the bare bones of it. I truthfully don't think I fully dove headfirst in and started to understand and grasp what those numbers mean, what 1% means. And I really just followed her lead and okay, she's doing fine and we just deal with it. And it wasn't until things started to change then that's where I feel like I became more involved from just fully engulfing and engaging myself in.
Can you talk about when things changed and then in your mind getting fully involved? What did that look like for you?
Yeah, so I think it wasn't until July of 2020 had been doing the routine every 3 month MRI. And they had kind of hinted at they saw something maybe coming back into the fold, because just for context here, Megan had her first craniotomy. They removed it and she was okay for 2 years. Then they were doing only one scan a year at that time, which in hindsight probably would have been better to be doing more than just one, but it's always easy to look back and say. But and so they did notice there was a change. And that was in 2018. So they did another surgery. And immediately following that, they did gamma knife radiation. And Megan has this crazy picture where she's smiling and her head is like screwed in. And she's got this awesome shirt on that says warrior. And so they did the gamma knife and then everything was fine again until 2020. And then I came into the fold. Everything, you know, was going well. In 2023, they said they started to notice a little bit of a change, but they weren't 100% sure. And then in 2023, in July and leading up to July, Megan was having these, they call them auras, in her arm. And we didn't really know what that was. She had gone into the emergency room and they kind of just said, okay, well, nothing really is happening. So, and then in July of 2023, Megan was living with her college roommate, in an apartment in Morristown, her roommate, Nicole, who is an RN nurse and is a superhero. I'm close to the microphone. Any nurse out there, you are absolutely wonderful and we love you. And Megan started to experience an aura and she called Nicole into her bedroom. And within minal, Megan was having a grand mal seizure, which was new and had never been a part of Megan's story before. Thank goodness Nicole was there. Nicole saved her life. When they got to the hospital, Nicole was the one that was already there. So Nicole was speaking to the doctors at the time. And she did give Megan mouth-to-mouth resuscitation because she did say Megan stopped breathing, which is very uncommon in a seizure. And actually the doctors were like, that didn't happen, but Nicole's a nurse. So she said it happened. So Nicole saved her life. So we absolutely love Nicole. And so I remember getting the call while I was at work and I just was like, what is happening? And I remember I called my brother and I was like, I have to get to the hospital. And my brother was like, you drive as fast as you can. And if you get a ticket, I'll pay for your ticket. And when I got to the hospital, it was crazy because then there she is, my beautiful fiance, who's just like awake now and is like, oh yeah, everything's fine. And I'm like, what do you mean everything's fine? That's not what I just heard. And Megan ended up being in the hospital for, I think it was 3 days while they were running tests, and I didn't leave the hospital, not once. I didn't care if they were going to kick me out. I slept in that uncomfy chair, and that's what a lot of caretakers, I'm sure, do in this kind of scenario. But that was when I was like, okay, now I need to start listening. Now I need to start asking questions because this is taking a little bit more of a serious turn, and clearly things aren't just, oh yeah, it's in the past, it's okay. Because now this was our present and was going to be our future. And so from there, we had to take action because there was going to be more seizures. They did happen. And so we had to really up our intensity and what we were going to do to try to tackle what was happening.
And when that happened in the hospital, what did they come back and tell you? The results of the tests they were doing, what's the plan moving forward?
Yeah. And so I think something that is probably helpful to Megan's story is post that gamma knife radiation and that second craniotomy, the sarcoma no longer was in like tumor form. Now, for everyone listening, I am an actor by trade. And so like I'm playing a role in which I'm pretending to understand. So if I am saying things a little incorrectly, not medical term, this is to the best of my understandings. And I think people who are listening who are caretakers are who are just someone who's experiencing this, maybe you'll find a little solace in how I talk about it because I really don't know the terminologies. But how it was explained to us was that after the gamma knife radiation, the sarcoma's form was kind of like spray paint on an orange or like spilt water. Like it was so thin that there was no more, they couldn't go back in and cut it out. It had kind of just almost this super thin, we'll say like spilt liquid. And so it had been on her occipital lobe and it started to move. And I think that's where it was now caught in between two lobes. And I think that's where these seizures came in. And so all they could really say was that we need you to refer back to your care team who had been dealing with this before, because obviously this was just at a hospital that was near Megan's apartment. So they were just getting caught up by what she was explaining. And so that's when we just realized the location had moved, because we had kept saying occipital lobe, and they said something different. So then that's when we were like, okay, maybe we need to go back to our original care team and have a more serious look at this and where we could go from there.
And from the care partner's perspective, when you found yourself in that situation and you said, okay, I've got to learn more about this, where did you go for information? What did you start to do to learn more?
Yeah, I think that is a very dangerous game, because Google is sometimes not your friend. And so I think it was more so asking Megan more questions. And then we got into these appointments, not being afraid to speak up. And we did see so many different doctors. And my role in that was, we would go to these appointments and it'd be Megan, myself, her father, Kevin, and her mother, Sharon. And I was kind of the one that just was sitting in the corner typing notes. And so that was really helpful as well, because then I would go back and reread them. And then we'd go to a different doctor and I'd say, well, actually the date was this. And they explained it as this. And so I kind of almost became like the secretary. And I think the more that I read it and the more that we had those conversations with Megan and the more questions I asked two doctors, and the doctors were great. I mean, they really would explain it in such a careful, unique way, because all of us in that room, none of us had a medical background. And so I think that the way medical professionals can really divulge and break it down for people who don't understand, that's such a talent in and of itself. And it wasn't until I decided to train for a half marathon that we found Sarcoma Foundation of America, because I had been going to all these appointments with Megan, and they were just, to be in the waiting room, it was some of the saddest days ever. I mean, it's just such a sad place to be. Cancer touches everybody. But when your partner's going through it and she's 26 at the time, and then someone behind you in line says, do you mind if we go before you? And it's a mother and her like 10-year-old little girl. I mean, it is a reality check. And so I remember I had a trainer, and I still do. His name is Tom. And I just messaged him and I said, I got to do something to help. I don't know what I have to do, but I got to do something. And I said, I think I want to run in a race. And before we even had discussion, he sent me a receipt for the Brooklyn Half Marathon. I said, Tom, are you nuts? I can't even run 10 minutes on the treadmill. And running became such an outlet for me. And then the next part of that mission was to find an organization to run for. And that's when Megan found SFA, and I began emailing back and forth with Annie, and I could just feel the warmth that your organization exudes from her emails. And like, we became like pen pals. And then I truthfully like dove into your guys' community, and there was so much there. And I mean, I'm wearing the shirt, and like I said, it felt like such a light in a time of darkness. And I was like, oh my goodness, there are so many other people experiencing this that we didn't even know about. We just thought, oh yeah, we're the people dealing with cancer, but it's the rare one. And no, there's a whole other community within this community that, you know, kind of made us feel a part of something.
Less alone.
Yeah, for sure.
Less alone. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it can be an incredibly isolating disease. So to find that is awesome. There's so much to talk about with your running, and we will get to that.
Yeah, of course.
I want to circle back to what you said. And I think this is so interesting that you called it out in a way of you don't have a medical background, but like you have learned so much just by going to these appointments and being a care partner. And I think what you said of other care partners listening can definitely relate to that feeling of, this is how it was explained to me. I might be misspeaking, but this is how I understand it. What would you recommend to someone who's just stepping into the care partner position and is trying to understand? What was helpful to you in breaking those things down in those appointments so that you could really support Megan?
Yeah, I think that in the beginning, I had this idea of I always needed to be on, and that I needed to be the smiling face and the happy relief to Megan on days that were really difficult and hard. And it always was perplexing to me that Megan, who was going through this, was the one asking me if I was okay, and was the one asking if everyone else was okay. And it wasn't until we were invited to the SFA gala last year that was a lot of other people's stories as well. These keynote speakers, these other survivors, were always so worried about everyone around them and putting everyone else before them first. And I think for me as a caretaker, the way I understood it, because truthfully, yes, there were family members of mine that had had cancer. My aunt had cancer. My grandmother had cancer. And I think that I'd had a touch of it, but it wasn't the primary person alongside in every one of these appointments. And I think realizing that although you are the caretaker, you are not selfish for feeling sad or having moments or spurts of anger, and knowing that you don't have to always be on because you are going through it as well. And that was really hard for me to wrap my head around, because in moments where I felt like my emotions were coming through, I said, this is selfish, Sean. This isn't about you. This is about Megan. And Megan just kept reassuring me, like, we are going through this together. And even saying that, it still feels like the incorrect verbiage. But I think for any caretaker out there, just know that you are a team and that it's okay to have the feelings that you're feeling, and it just communicate. Because when you try to put on and push those down, if you're not being the best authentic you, you can't be the support for someone that they need. You have to feel all the feelings and just know that you'll get through the other side.
I think it's interesting you said that you always felt like you needed to be the happy one to relieve her. I think having been a caregiver, I've talked a couple of times, and Natasha's heard me talk a lot about this. You have to be the one to push those feelings down. Exactly what you said, that that's what we think we need to do. But it's interesting that as we talk to more people, especially through this podcast, and we hear them saying, I always feel like I need to be on, and some days I don't want to be. Like you said, Sean, that communication is so important, because you have both sides feeling like I need to be on, I need to be the happy person, I need to make sure I'm looking out for other people, and I always have to be happy when sometimes I don't feel like being that way. And that communication is so important on how you can move forward as a team. Because understanding that you're both hurting, it's hard for both of you in different ways, but it's still difficult for both of you. And when you have that understanding of that difficulty, I think it can bring you closer together in a sense.
Oh my goodness, absolutely. And I think the real kind of moment that was where I realized, like, okay, how I'm coping with this isn't okay, was Megan had done a clinical trial. It was sometimes I was allowed to go back and sometimes I was not. And it was a day that she was just beat up. We were traveling into New York, and I mean, we were going on the subway, and it was just, we'd have to leave our apartment at like 5:45 in the morning. And it was just like a long, and I wish there was a way for me to make it easier, but believe it or not, the train to then the subway to then the walk was the easiest way. And Megan had gone back, and I have the brave face on, and Megan goes in the back, and I just broke down in the lobby. I mean, I was a mess. And it was actually one of the custodians who came over to me and said, are you okay? And I said, yeah, I'm okay. And she put her hand on my shoulder and she said, are you okay? And then I kind of just looked at her and she said, you know, they have things here. You can talk to people, you know, have to look out for you as well. And that was kind of a rare moment from a stranger that was just so important to me, because I don't think we go through our day-to-day lives and a smile means so much, because you literally have no idea what someone is going through. And, you know, with this trial, Megan didn't lose her hair. And so I remember even when Megan got all the way to the end, like I said, and she rang the bell, you know, Megan works remote and she's not on camera. And when her boss was like, can I share what happened today? Everyone congratulated Megan, but was like, wait a minute, what? Megan never called out of work. She would go to these clinical trials, or when we would then later go to radiation, and Megan would do that all and be on Zoom, you know, no camera by 9:30. Like, she never stopped working. So it was one of those where it was a wow moment for me. And that, thank you and shout out to that random lady in that hospital, because she really kind of shifted how we navigated the rest of the past, you know, year.
And you mentioned running was an outlet for you and became a coping mechanism for you. Can you talk about that and maybe other ways that you found the services that you were told that the institution that you were attending and being seen at, that the services that they had, if you took advantage of any of those?
Yeah, I wish I did take advantage of them. I did not, because even though I'm saying it now with clarity that it's okay to feel the feelings, I don't think until I started to come around to be like, I need to take care of myself more. But I, talking about it, sometimes it felt okay and sometimes it didn't. And so I think that's why I did go more towards the running. Like I said, we booked this half marathon and it was like, okay, I'm going to do this, but I didn't believe that I could do this because I come from a basketball household. Like my dad coached, my brother played, and I watched. So I really was not, you know, I went to a small private Catholic high school, and in my 4 years, like we lost every single football game. I was on JV soccer, but like that wasn't an accomplishment because there wasn't even a freshman team. So like athlete and me are not synonymous. And so when my trainer, Tom, said, we're going to do this. And he said, and we're going to raise a lot of money. He began running. And like I said, I couldn't do more than 10 minutes on the treadmill without having to walk. And then I just thought, not only to Megan, but to all people battling cancer, and it doesn't even have to be sarcoma, like they're showing up and they're doing something they don't want to be doing and they don't know that they can be doing. And so little by little, I started to get a little bit better and I could run a little bit longer. And it was one of those things where you had to show up, because if you didn't meet the runs for that week, you weren't going to be ready. So it was the first time I'd ever really followed such a strict training program as well. And yeah, it did kind of become an outlet, because when I would be running and I was tired or I felt like I needed to walk, then I'd be like, okay, well, you got to dig deep because, you know, Megan showed up today. And so I kind of pulled from her strength. It became something that I didn't enjoy, but it became so necessary to me, because I would go out and have a run and it didn't go well. And then I was like waiting to have the next run to just be like, okay, well, the next one's going to be better. And as of last Saturday, I just completed my second half marathon. And the first one, my trainer and his wife ran by my side. And we raised over $8,000 for SFA. And that was another motivator as well, because as soon as financial implications get involved, then there's a little bit of a pressure because people are believing in you. And I always kept saying, everyone's betting on the horse and the horse is nervous. The first one in August, it was so beautiful because not only did my trainer fly across country with his wife, he had never trained for a half marathon either. Neither did his wife and neither did I. And so it was three neophytes tackling 13.1 miles for such a cause bigger than all of us. And that's actually where I introduced, it's called my why list, and spelled W-H-Y. And I think when you find your purpose as to why you want to do something, you can really accomplish anything. And that list started with Megan's name. And then anyone who felt comfortable with sharing a name of someone who they knew who had battled or had been battling or had been touched by cancer, I asked them to share that name with me if they felt comfortable. And I wrote their names down on the why list. And the list has about close to 50 names on it. And it was in my pocket throughout the entirety of the first half marathon. And it was in my pocket in the second, as well as, you know, in my hand. Because at moments when it's hard and the road feels long and your legs are heavy and your breathing is shallow, like I looked down at that list and I was like, it's for them. We need to all cross this finish line together. And then, yeah, I'm happy to report that after the second half marathon, we didn't quite get to 3,000. I think we're at like 2,900 or 2,800. And so over $10,000 to SFA. And myself, Tom, Jenna Lee, we crossed the finish line, and all those names in my pocket as well.
That's incredible. And congratulations on
those. Thank you.
You ran a whole marathon.
Essentially. I know.
It'd be a good time to plug also that we're still recruiting for our Marine Corps marathon in, October?
Yeah, might be your time to train, Sean.
Well, listen, I've been going back and forth with Annie, and she's been saying, and I don't want to give too much away, but there is a marathon close by that you are in final consideration to be a sponsor for. And that's the one I kind of have my eyes on. I don't want to give anything away, but
all right.
Yeah.
More to come on that.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's fantastic.
That is amazing. And it sounds like there's two things that you've gotten out of the running. One is awareness, fundraising, and doing something. It sounds like the original motivation to run was to do something. You know, you're sitting in this room with Megan, watching her have to do a lot physically and mentally to go through a sarcoma diagnosis. And you're like, well, what can I physically do to support? But it almost sounds like the secondary benefit was that it was an outlet for you as a care partner. Absolutely. To take time for yourself in addition. So that's really amazing, because I think you need both. And I'm wondering for you, since there are multiple reasons as to why you ran, do you draw any, I guess, dualities between training and treatment from the care partner perspective?
Wow, that is a really good pull. Yeah, I think so, because for both, you know, you have to be present. And I think your mindset is the biggest thing. It's your mindset is your biggest tool. And so, yeah, I think that there is some parallels. And it's funny that you say that, because a lot of time when I was advertising the run and you know, asking for donations, I said, I know that running in a race and battling cancer are not the same. But yes, I do think that from a standpoint of whether you're someone who is going through treatment or you're there with someone while they're going through treatment, and then you are training for something that you're putting your body through. At the end of the day, it's your body going through it, but you have to have a mindset to allow your body to believe that it can do it. And so, yeah, I would very much say so. Yeah, I think that there is a kind of a parallel because mindset's such a big part of both of those obstacles.
Yeah, and I feel like you also, in your survey, talked a little bit about Megan's mindset. And she had a quote about mindset relative to going through treatment. So Megan's quote that you shared with us was, your only limitation is your own ingenuity.
Yeah. Megan was honored by the American Cancer Society Tides of Change with the Survivor of the Year of 2024. And that quote that you just read was actually her yearbook quote. So serendipitous that she found meaning in that quote nearly 10 years into this. I mean, we're approaching 10 years of Megan dealing with this. And I think that it's so true, because your only limitation is if you don't allow yourself to reinvent yourself. And, you know, no one in their 20s wants to be experiencing cancer. And Megan kind of just always says in her mindset, it's like, she said, this is something that I was born with, and this is just something that I have to deal with. And I've always kind of mirrored it to, it's her carrying a torch, and she's never backed away from it. She's never said, why me? If anything, she doesn't even worry about herself. Like I've said, she's always worried about everyone else around her. And her mindset is just that, I am going to beat this, and I am going to do that so other people don't feel so alone. And one of mine and Megan's universal signs is, we see rainbows everywhere. And that's because we've just said, this has felt like a storm, but she's been this light that shines through. And I think it's awesome that sarcoma's color is this like beautiful bright yellow, because that it really is true in the way she carries it. She just deals with it. I kind of compare it to, I grew up in a basketball household, and Kobe Bryant, he was just the coolest. And so much has come out about him since his passing, and all these amazing stories of how he just tackled his workouts and just like had this mindset. They call it like the Mamba mentality. And when Megan was going through treatment, we'd always say, Megan's in a fight with a bear, pray for the bear. And it's just the truth. She cool as a cucumber. Like, even when sometimes these treatments, especially the clinical trial, was a little invasive and intense, cool as a cucumber. Like, I got it. And so sometimes we'd be holding hands. I think I'd be the one squeezing her hand. Like, are you sure you're okay? But no, her mindset is, it's unbelievable. It is so inspiring. If, you know, as sad as those days can be and as hard as they can be some of the most inspiring days ever, because you're watching someone you love go through this, and for her to handle it with such poise and grace, tenacity, and just badassness. I mean, yeah, that's, you can go run a half marathon right now. You just need a couple sessions. You'll do it.
When you started on this journey with Megan and realized, okay, I'm going to have to play a bigger role in this to be supportive. And I liked your term, became the secretary of sorts, because every team needs that, right? Did you connect with other people in your position, other other care partners or and get any resources for them? And how did you figure out this is the role I'm going to play? And what resources did you use for yourself to figure that out? Or did it just come to you?
I think I'm going to go with the latter. It kind of did just come to me. And it was a lot of leaning on both sets of parents, like both my parents and Megan's parents. And just in those quiet moments, like having those really difficult conversations. And I'm sure I'm obviously not a parent yet. And I don't wish that conversation on a parent. But basically going to them and saying, what if everything's not going to be okay? And that vulnerability and that hug from a mom and dad when maybe they don't have the answers to give you, but knowing they're just as scared as you are. And for the first time, I would say I felt like on even playing field with people that were older than me, because we were all in this and we were all just as scared. But we knew that there was so much power and love in those moments of embrace that we're going to get through this. And there was only one other individual who I was speaking to at the time. And it was a friend that we kind of reconnected through this. Her mother was dealing with a glioblastoma. And it was really just text messages back and forth. Some days the text messages were really detailed. And other days it was like, this is really tough. And not like misery loves company, but it was nice to know that, okay, someone else is going through this as well, and they're my age, and how are they dealing with it? And kind of just knowing that when you do open up and look around, like there are a lot of people, there's no age requirement. Like, it's going to affect anybody. And so, yeah, leaning on each other in that and trying to help each other any way we could to get through.
We talk with patients and survivors about what did people do for you that was most helpful while you were going through treatment or recovering. But for you as a care partner, what did people do for you that was the most supportive so that you could show up for Megan?
I think not being afraid to have the conversation and ask me how I'm doing. Because I could imagine if I was a friend of someone who was a caretaker, maybe trying to avoid the conversation because it is awkward in a sense. What am I supposed to ask you? What are you supposed to say to me? It's not as easy as everything's going to be okay, which of course you do want to hear. But I think what was amazing about my community was that they saw how much I cared for Megan and they did as well. And so they didn't shy away from those conversations of, hey, what's going on? And allowing me to be 100% vulnerable and in turn them getting emotional and being invested as well. And I think that's really important is that this is real, it's real life. And I am so thankful to any and anyone who reached out and was willing to put themselves out on the line because talking about this kind of stuff can be really difficult and really hard. And I'm just so thankful that people didn't shy away and really were always checking in. There were individuals who the name would pop up on the phone and I'd be like, what? I didn't even, or, you know, people who hadn't even met Megan. But when something like this happens, people come out of the woodworks in a great way to make you feel supported. And whether it was weekly check-ins or, you know, song suggestions to listen to on the way to treatment or Uber Eats, you know, it really... we'll never be able to say thank you enough to all the people who really helped us champion through that whole experience.
I like those examples because I think that's a takeaway anybody listening could say if they're looking for a way to support a care partner. Oh, send them a song. You don't realize how far those things go until you hear someone talk about how many years later you're still talking about those things.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And also giving you the space to share how you feel too, right? And that is separate from certainly you and Megan are able to have those conversations, but also having another outlet outside of the person going through it to be able to have those conversations and say, I'm scared. I'm having a hard time. I don't see the light at the end of the tunnel. I don't know what the future is going to look like. It's scary. To be able to have those conversations without feeling guilty or without feeling like you're pressuring the person going through it. Or as you said, being selfish and dumping them, but those are real feelings. And I love the way you said, like with the parents, we were all scared. I think that is such a key word from the family side and from the care partner side is, I'm scared too. I know it's not me going through it, but I'm scared too. And I don't know what this looks like. And having a safe space to talk about that is so important to be able to deal with those emotions and then be able to then, okay, I'm ready now to jump back in and be able to provide that support.
Yeah, that is needed. Absolutely.
You mentioned the clinical trial that Megan was on. And can you talk about the clinical trial that she was on and how you supported her with that? And you mentioned already having to travel in, which I know you're in New Jersey and you had to go into New York, which some people would think, well, that doesn't seem like far, but I understand what you're saying. It can take forever just to go from New Jersey into New York. But did she have to travel anywhere else? What was that experience like for the two of you?
Yeah, so I think originally when Megan had her first seizure, she had had a care team in which she, or a doctor who she wanted to see, but he was in transit to a different hospital. And when doctors are in transit, you're until they're completely set up, you're not allowed to see them. So that's where we pivoted. We found out about this clinical trial that the belief was they were going to put an Ommaya reservoir, which is like a port in her head. That would be her third brain surgery. So they put this port in that will now be there forever. And they were going to administer a medicine called deferoxamine. And it was an iron deficiency medicine. And the idea was that it would pull the iron because cancer needs iron to survive. And so, that took place in New York City. And so we would travel from our apartment to New York to, I think there was two or three different locations. And we did that for about 2-ish months. And Megan was also on a chemo pill at the time that was, they believed that her sarcoma had a very similar mutation to melanoma. And so they were trying to attack that. And the medicine actually was working. However, Megan was like viciously and violently allergic to the medicine. So we had to get her off of that. And then once the seizure happened, the clinical trial, we had actually just, I think we had maybe one more session of it. But at that time, the seizure happened in December. Megan actually had two different seizures. She had a grand mal seizure. And then immediately after, she had a subclinical seizure. And a subclinical seizure, for those who are listening, if you don't know what that is, it's just as scary as a grand mal seizure. However, it's almost like the lights are on and no one's home. And so Megan had had that and was rushed to the hospital. And for 3 days, this was all right before Christmas, for 3 days, Megan really couldn't speak. And when she did come to, had no idea what was going on. She didn't know who I was. And sorry. And so that was where I feel like I really got thrusted. That's where I feel like I kind of took on a more serious role in that moment, because now Megan isn't speaking for herself. I'm speaking for her and I'm speaking on behalf of her. And thank goodness I took all those notes because I had them all for the doctors. And it wasn't until it was like 8 o'clock at night. And this is maybe the second day she was in the hospital. And we got a call from that doctor who we originally wanted to see, who wasn't set up at his hospital. And he'd said, hey, I just happened to be looking at Megan's files. This is like Friday night at 8 o'clock. He's like, I happened to be like looking at Megan's chart and I see that she had some tests done today. Is everything okay? We weren't even with him at that moment, but out of the kindness of his heart and just being intuitive because he knew we were trying to see him. And that's when I like broke down and told him no and I've explained everything. And then he kind of came back into the fold and we then were no longer traveling into New York. We were traveling out to Trenton and he suggested we actually flew out to Nebraska. And so we flew out to Nebraska to see a specialist. And when we went out there, there was all these like universal signs, like we were right where we were supposed to be. After Megan's first surgery, before the clinical trial, I wanted to get her something. And so I went to the hospital like store and Megan and I met on Bumble, which the dating app. And there was a gnome, Megan's father loves gnomes. There was a bumblebee gnome in this gift shop. And so I bought it for Megan. And so now we're in Nebraska. And at this point, I don't want to say this feels like something you shouldn't say, but when your back's against the wall, you're like, are we running out of options, right? And so now we're in Nebraska. We are just hoping that this doctor is going to be some sort of savior to us. And we're in Nebraska and we walk into this, they have this like Christmas store. It's not Christmas time. And they just sell like all this Christmas stuff. And we walk in and the first thing on the right-hand side is the same exact bumblebee gnome. The same exact one. And it was full body goosebumps. And you're like, are you kidding me? And we went to the appointment and we walk out of the appointment. What's the first thing we see? A rainbow. And that woman changed our life. And we traveled back to New York, to New Jersey. And the doctor who called and checked in and this woman from Nebraska devised this plan. And then we ended up doing radiation down where Megan grew up. And so the commute became a little bit easier. One of the coolest parts about it was every time Megan went in for the treatment, they always played a song while she was in the machine, and she'd come out and I'd be like, what was the song today? And so I would write down all the songs. And then on our last day when we were traveling before she got to ring the bell, I had all the songs on like a Spotify playlist in the car. And so, yeah. So, I mean, traveling into New York, it wasn't easy. And, you know, traveling down 35 minutes via car 5 days a week, it wasn't easy, but it was one of those things where I was willing to do whatever and wake up however early and what needed to be. And anyone listening knows I am not a morning person. You know, it ended up all working out exactly the way it was supposed to.
Well, Sean, I first have to say, earlier in this conversation, you said you are not a Casanova. But as you've spoken about all of these things that you have done, at some point you're going to have to tell us how you proposed, because that Spotify list, I was like, wow. You know, yeah. You see those memes a lot where there's pictures. It's like, I want someone who looks at me like that.
Yeah. If she's not making you a Spotify playlist, not it, honey.
Stop. You're making me blush. Stop.
I was going to say, so you're telling me you're having a bumblebee gnome themed wedding here.
Listen, if Bumble's listening to this podcast, and I hope that they are, we will take any donations to that wedding. Please.
Bumble wants to sponsor the podcast. Yeah, no. Listen.
Yeah, that's great. A lot of opportunity. No.
But you do, you know, bring, this is a great example of the lengths that people have to go to find options when like you said, up against a wall or dealing with a rare cancer and a rare subtype within that rare cancer.
Mm-hmm.
That it doesn't mean you can just go down the street to your local center and come up with a plan. And that's a real challenge for the sarcoma community. That is really highlighted by your experience with that.
Yeah. And I did ask Megan, like before I came on the episode, I said, is there anything you want me to say on your behalf? And she did say that to anyone who is dealing with this, that don't be afraid to take that leap and to travel. Because I remember she was really weary in the beginning. Like, I don't know that I want to go out there. And sometimes that doctor is in that place that you've never been, and to go into the unknown is scary, but we are so thankful that we did. And so Megan did want me to share that. If there is ever a suggestion to travel, just go hear them out, because they could change and save your life.
Yeah, I would say that Nebraska is not one of the first places, nothing against Nebraska, but you know, it's not one of the first places people always think about to go when we think about sarcoma centers. So sometimes it's, where's the best care for what you in particularly have, right? There's a lot of big name institutions out there. There's a lot of great sarcoma centers out there. And sometimes it's not always the place that you would necessarily first think of, but it might be the best place for you.
Absolutely. Not a one size fits all, unfortunately.
Exactly.
So Sean, a word that you mentioned in the beginning was community. And it sounds like you and Megan have a very strong community around you, but you also mentioned being introduced to the sarcoma community. And I'm curious in your perspective, we hear from patients a lot of like, yes, I met someone who has the same subtype as me and it was, you know, game changer. I met someone who just understands what I'm going through. How has the sarcoma community supported you as a care partner?
I found so much support the first time I actually went to an event, the race for sarcoma in New Jersey. It was like right after my half marathon in the city, and Megan was supposed to come to the race, but was not having a great day. So I actually went by myself, and it was like the perfect introduction to meeting people from the organization. You know, I branded us as we're Team Megcellence. And so everyone there was signs and there were teams, and I was probably the only person that at least obviously was there by myself. And I remember finishing the race and I wanted to take a picture. And there was a family and I said, can you take a picture of me? And they said, of course. And then they said, are you here by yourself? And I said, yeah, I am. And then they invited me to be with them. And it was just like open arms. And it was just such a happy day trying to raise funds for this amazing organization. And there was face painters and there was bagels. And it was just, I didn't know what to expect. And I already looked up, the next one is in October, and like we will have a huge representation there. And it was just really awesome to go to something like that and be around people who were dealing with something that Megan had dealt with. And there were people that spoke. And it was really just eye-opening to know, like, the word sarcoma to me was synonymous with Megan, and to know other people have sarcomas as well. And, you know, 1% sounds like such a low number, but there's a lot of people in that number. And to go to that day by myself, which I didn't want to go by myself, but it ended up being like such a blessing because it kind of felt like I got a medal, and it felt like that was the moment where like we were towards the end of her treatment, and it felt like, okay, like this is a beautiful day and there's a lot of people here who have been dealing with this for a long time, and that's going to be our story as well. And yeah, I just felt and that was the day that I was like, oh my goodness, you know, there is so much joy in something that could be joyless. And, you know, just feeling all that festivity around just a random day in a park that became so much more.
Yeah, I always say 1% sounds so small, but 1% is someone's spouse, someone's mother, someone's father, someone's sister, brother, child. Mm-hmm. That 1% is not small to the person who is caring for that person or the mm-hmm. person themselves. I'm glad you mentioned that.
So tell us, where are you now in your journey with sarcoma? Where is Megan in terms of her treatment, and where does that stand?
Yeah, so last March, Megan was actually the first person to ever ring the bell at the hospital in which she had gotten treatment, which is amazing. So there's a caveat to that. I remember I'd asked the doctors and the nurses, and they said, well, we're in the process of getting a bell. We don't have one yet, but we'll do something special for Megan. And so when Megan came out of the room, it was myself, my parents, Megan's parents, her aunt and uncle, my brother, my sister-in-law was on FaceTime, and we were there. We had all these signs, and Megan came out, and they gave her this like little handheld bell that she was ringing. And when we went back for our checkup, there actually is a bell there now, which is so cool and goosebumps. And so Megan rang the bell last March, and we say, you know, that's a step towards healing. We don't know that we're ever going to get remission fully. You know, Megan's already been dealing with this for almost 10 years, and you know, that's what the doctors have said, that we don't know that we're ever going to get a year in remission. But as long as we can get to these windows of everything's okay, then that's great. Well, because in between each episode, if you want to call it that, there's been years. And so the doctor in Nebraska said, I don't know if I can cure this thing, but I sure as heck want to try to kill it. And, you know, her main doctor here says, you know, this isn't a thing where we're trying to get through the holidays. There's a long life to be had here. So Megan was still on a chemo pill that she had recently gotten off of. And we just had our first scan where Megan is not on the chemo pill, and everything has stayed stable. And in the scan prior to the one that stable, they even said they saw a little bit of shrinkage, which they just kind of keep saying, we don't know how this is happening. We don't know where you came from, but you know, she is really just defying the odds against this. And so I say that we might not get remission, but as a thespian, we are now in an intermission, which is where Megan can start to feel more like herself. And that means, you know, getting back into the gym. And Megan loves the beach. She absolutely loves the beach. She's got this like beautiful tan skin. And with the chemo pill, she wasn't allowed to be out in the sun. So this summer we will be out at the beach. She'll be getting tan, I'll be getting sunburned. But no, it's Megan is on her way to healing. Her hair is growing back in. And what has been crazy, and we can't really explain, Megan was a blonde when I met her. as my girlfriend and now as my fiance. She is a white-haired, beautiful lady. And that's actually what drew us to our dog Clifford, who is an English Red Lab. He's got red hair, but he's got this random white patch on his chest. And we didn't know where that came from. And Megan was like, why is my hair white? Why does this dog have a random white spot? And so even when Megan, her hair is fully back in whatever color, whatever texture, whatever, we'll always have that little reminder in Cliff. And it's like right by his heart. Like, you can't write it better than that. And so last March, like I said, she finished treatment. And this March, we got engaged and got a puppy. And so I'm just so excited for like life to begin. And, you know, as someone who is an actor, I've done a lot of traveling and been on cruise ships and, you know, was on tour with a show called Kinky Boots for a couple of years. And I'm just so happy to have found this woman. And I'm so ready to like, and when I asked her parents if I could have her hand in marriage, I said like, the greatest role I'll ever play is husband to Megan. And I'm just so excited for the future. And I think that the fact that I'm on a podcast talking about sarcoma with two representatives from the Sarcoma Foundation, talking about the future, like a year ago, Sean wouldn't believe that we could be saying these sentences out loud. And I'm just so thankful that I'm not only saying them, but I believe them and that there's so much in store for Megan and I, and I just can't wait.
Well, we're so excited for you and happy to hear of her stability and her intermission and all that the two of you have on the horizon. So much to look forward to. And, you know, we love to hear that. All right, Casanova, where can people find you if they're looking to be a part of the sarcoma community?
Yeah, and absolutely.
They want to talk to you. Where can they find you?
Yeah, if anyone wants to send me an email, please do. My email is my last name and my first name. So it's N as in Nemo, ERNEYSHAUN@gmail.com. Yes, my name is Sean, spelled SHAUN. No keychains for me as a kid. And on Instagram, my handle is chronicles_of_Nernia.
And we'll link that so people can easily find you. But before we go, is there any last advice you want to give? Anything we didn't cover that you want to talk about?
Yeah, no, I mean, as far as advice goes, I mean, there's no manual on how to deal with this, whether you're someone who's going through it or being by someone's side as they're going through it. But I just think that it's so important to allow yourself to feel everything that each day brings and then have the conversations that you don't want to have, because in the moment when you're having them, they're so difficult, they're so hard, but you'll be so thankful that you had them. And you'll look back on them and remember them and pull from them and be stronger getting towards that finish line that you're trying to get to. And yeah, I'm just so thankful to everyone who's reached out to Megan and I. And I know that if you're going through this, there's people in your lives who are looking to help. So don't shy away. Don't isolate. It's really easy to probably want to deal with this in private, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I think if you do let that wall down and let people in, you'll be so amazed by how uplifted you really can feel. We're just so thankful that we allowed people in. Like I said, Megan was very private about this in the past. Obviously, this go around, things were a little bit more obvious. And we're just so over the moon that, you know, people reached out and cared. And I'm just really thankful and happy that we found you guys and that we could help shed a little bit of light onto sarcoma and the sarcoma community, because although it is, you know, a smaller amount of people dealing with it than, you know, a lot of other cancers, it's just as important. And the funding and the research is so important. And like you said, that 1%, it could be someone's sister, brother, mom, aunt, cousin, fiance, and they just need help and support. And so podcasts like this are just amazing to try to get that attention brought on there. And yeah, so I guess just lean on the people around you, because there's a lot of people who want to help. Maybe someone out there will be inspired to run a race for you. I would run to the end of the world for Megan. So,
well, Sean, I want to say thank you so much for all that you do to raise awareness for sarcoma and the money that you raise for SFA. And I say this a lot, SFA is just a conduit, right? It's not about SFA. It is about the funding of research. It is about better outcomes for people. That is absolutely the fabric of our organization and something we truly believe in. But I also have to say, also, you have got to be one of the best hype men I have ever encountered. And that's an amazing thing to be. And I feel it just from talking to you on this podcast. So that is a truly inspiring role. And this conversation today has really inspired me. And I really appreciate your time.
And thank you so much for saying that.
All right, Sean. Well, thank you so much for being here today. We are so excited for you and Megan's next step. You're going to have to send us pictures from the wedding and everything.
Will do. Will do. Thank you so much. And please don't be strangers. I loved getting to chat with you. I feel like we're friends. So thank you.
Of course.
Thanks for joining us today. Did this episode resonate with you? You can join the discussion about this episode in our Sarcoma Stories Facebook group, linked in the show notes. If you found this podcast helpful, your feedback is incredibly valuable and helps to create more awareness about sarcoma while sharing vital resources with someone who may need it. Be sure to leave a rating and review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.